Call the meeting to order. A few housekeeping details. This is informational only, just so everybody knows. No votes be taken, so we are making sure that we're following all rules, policies, and procedures, right? We also have individuals calling in, various members calling in. So if you hear that beep, that's what that is all about. We will, if the members that are on the phone are on the line currently, if you have any questions, go ahead. We're going to keep this pretty informal. Just like that, all right? We're going to keep it pretty informal. What I'd like to do, we do have a new member. I'd like Nick to introduce himself. However, before we get into that, Representative Hansen and I were talking. What we'd like to do is just take a moment to recognize a member, Representative Dill. Representative Hansen, would you like to say a few words as well?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is probably one of the first meetings since Representative Dill's passing. And I think all of us are deeply saddened by the loss of Representative David Dill. David was a member of this committee, and I think, as we discussed, if we could have a moment of silence in his memory, I think it would be appropriate and well deserved.
So if everybody would please stand for a moment of silence. Thank you. We also have an introduction. Nick, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, Nick Lunenborg. I'm the new committee legislative assistant for the Agriculture Finance Committee. Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. With that, I believe, Mr. Nisley, do you need to have anybody on the phone announce themselves at this point in time? All right. At this point in time, the individuals that called in, as organized as we possibly can you just let us know who's all on the phone, if you would, please?
Mr. Chair, this is Dan Fabian. I'm here in Badger, Minnesota, at the home of John Burkle.
Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, as well. Dave Baker out in the fabulous town of Wilmer, Minnesota.
Thank you for joining us, Representative Baker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keel. And there was one more?
Tim Stoltz from Duluth.
All right, thank you. Anybody else? All right. So, again, if anybody chimes in during this, we may recognize the individuals that called back in. So we're going to be as orderly as we possibly can, but there may be a few interruptions. What we're going to do now is we're going to call the producers. We'd like to gain their perspective. So I did talk with Ms. Frank. If you'd like to start making your way up front. We've called this meeting because what we'd like to do is we'd like to get visiting with the governor's office and Mr. Cruz with the Department of Agriculture as well. We'd just like to do briefly past, present, and future. A quick recap, and what we wanted to do is have this meeting before we got in full swing of harvest, but also in the event we need to be prepared for anything coming our way this fall. We want to make sure that we are adequately informed and prepared. We would like to hear from producers because, like we said, we're all in this together. And again, I can't thank enough for everybody pulling together. It doesn't matter what party you belong to, what body you serve in, the governor's office, the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, USDA, everybody has come together. And we want to make sure that if there are anything, if there's anything that we need to address or do better, we want to hear about that as well. We want to gain industry perspective. So again, we're all in this together. Give credit where credit is due. You know, the governor has led on this, has been a champion, and everybody around sitting in this room has as well. It's been refreshing to see people come together and address this. So with that, we'll start with Ms. Frank, and then we'll call up Mr. Olson. You'll be the second, I believe, to testify. So if you'd state your name and who you represent for the record and begin, please. Ms. Frank.
Do I need to use the microphone?
If you would, please. Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay. My name's Barb Frank, and I own the Pullet Connection in Danube, Minnesota, with my daughter, Becky, and her husband, Sean. For the last 38 years, we've raised starter pullets on our farm. We have the rare distinction of being a woman-owned family farm being passed on to my daughter. On June 1st, 2015, we became Renville 7 when our farm went AI positive. That day began a nightmare that continues to today. Becky was quoted in the local paper as saying, "When my son died of SIDS in 2008, it was the worst week of my life. Now she thinks it's the second worst. When Dominic died, it was horrible, but we only had to get through that week and we could begin trying to heal. But this keeps on going and going. It doesn't end, and I'm fighting for everything I have." Among the most troublesome issues we had were, we were never personally notified of our diagnosis. The diagnostic lab made an error in spite of the fact that I turned in the paperwork myself and talked with the receptionist. I drove them to St. Paul. They never called us. In fact, this last week was the first time I ever saw anything in writing that our birds were positive. All 415,000 of my birds were destroyed with no formal confirmation to me. We were told that we would hear from our case manager the night of the diagnosis by our own vet. That was Monday night. The first person we saw was a driver delivering 18 porta potties on Wednesday morning, followed by 18 van loads of people who were set to destroy the birds without any conversation at all. Can you imagine the scene 18 van loads of people on a gravel road makes for the neighbors? The case manager arrived 5 hours after those vans. She would not enter our homes because she said they were within the contamination zone. That was her opinion. What she did give us was a packet that contained a Minnesota Department of Ag 2015 calendar, paperwork showing how to prevent avian influenza, who to report to once you have it, biosecurity guidelines, her card, and a paper on composting birds. Not very appropriate information for somebody who's in the midst of this, pardon me, shitstorm. She wouldn't come to our farm, so we talked in her car in the rain, a third of a mile from our house on the gravel roads, sometimes standing on the road talking. The destruction of our flocks was beyond what your imaginations can imagine. We were not allowed to use crews that knew what they were doing, and I can assure you that if we had taken pictures, we would be having a different type of hearing here than we are now. It took 4 days to kill the first barn, the first 135,000. The case manager didn't want feed brought in to save the government money, so the birds starved for those 4 days. When we talked to the USDA foreman about it, we were told it doesn't really matter, they're going to die anyway. Once we complained enough, that case manager was removed from our case, and a new one was assigned from the Minnesota Department of Ag. Things began to turn around. We were able to direct the cleaning with experienced crews and our own people. In 35 days after we began the formal cleanup, our barns were cleaned and disinfected, and we entered the 21-day waiting period. And on day 22, we housed chicks in the barn. To this moment, the birds are now 4 weeks old. We have not seen a dime of the cleanup money, in spite of the fact that my financial work plan essentially is the same as it was when I first submitted it on June 30th, except for USDA has disallowed the damages done by the crew they hired. They have disallowed the supplies that their foreman requested to protect the public from what was happening on our farm, and they have disallowed the damage, the cutting open of the barns to get the litter out because it rained. The estimated $266,000 cleanup remains 100% in my pocket right now. I did not even receive the $3,000 emergency advance that we sign paperwork for in June. In my opinion, when this happens again in the future, a few things need to be considered. Number one, case managers need to be better vetted and need to remain with the case until it is released from quarantine. Case managers who refuse to witness killing cannot manage a case of avian influenza, especially in chickens. Also, changing case managers every 21 days does not help the process. We must be allowed to use industry crews. They're more experienced, and frankly, they care more about the birds, the barns, and the work. We must be able to use people who are willing to work more than 40 hours a week. These jobs, especially the depopulation, must be done as quickly as possible. Crews who work 20 minutes on and 40 off, and crews who leave at 2:30 on Thursday because their 40 hours are in, do not work for depopulation. Contract crews need to be held accountable for their damages. If USDA hired them and they are being paid directly by USDA, that check should not go off until the farm signs off that no damages were done that need to be taken into account. Right now, I'm being told I must sue the contract crews to get my damages refunded. The names and contact information of all crews hired by USDA should be given to the farm before they are allowed access on the farm. Payments need to be more timely. 2 months for USDA to do their part on the work plan is unconscionable. Input needs to come more from those of us on the ground. There seems to be an attitude that the officials will figure this out. We hear over and over that this issue is largely biosecurity. That may be true in turkeys, but not so much in chickens. After each outbreak, the state does an audit of the farm. There was 24 pages of questions about everything we did and didn't do. When it was finished, we were told, "We have no advice for you. You did everything we are suggesting." If we're to find answers to this, we need more cooperative communication amongst everybody. Studying a case like ours would yield more of a true cause instead of the low-hanging fruit of biosecurity in the turkeys. And finally, we were working on an expansion when we broke with avian influenza. We did receive our EAW and our MPDES. However, the risk is too great at this time to invest another $5 million in our operation. We need some kind of safety net in the face of these disasters. Without that, only the largest companies with the deepest pockets will remain in the poultry industry, and the smaller farms like us will be squeezed out.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Frank? Chair Anderson.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frank, your testimony is alarming, to say the least. Could you tell us, the crews that worked on your farm in the cleanup operation, are they all federal crews or state crews or a mixture of both?
The depopulation crew was a crew hired by USDA. The original crew, I have no idea where they came from. Obviously not from our area. They were all African American. I have a name and that's it. I don't know anything else about it. I've requested more information 5 times. I have the name of the company. It's USES, and that's all I know. We attempted to get them to allow us to use our crews that typically work with the birds. We had voluntarily depopulated a flock 3 weeks before we went AI positive because there was nowhere for them to go. We used our own crew, and in a day and a half, we had 135,000 birds dead without this, pardon me, and I hope this doesn't cause problems where it goes, this Dachau effect, because we felt like Dachau.
Sure.
Our cleanup crew was our own that we use for other things, and that went phenomenally well.
Chair Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So when you said your own crew depopulated one barn, did you have to get the approval of somebody, state again or federal, to do that, to start that process?
No, because we were voluntarily killing those birds because there was nowhere to go. We were not AI positive. And if people don't realize this, millions of birds were killed in this state because they were pullets with no laying farm left to go in as Iowa broke and we broke. There's nowhere for them to go. So this was a voluntary kill that nobody paid for except the owner of the birds and us.
Chair Anderson, follow-up.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Your suggestions will be looked at a great deal. Just wondering about your comment about a safety net. Do you have any ideas or common sense suggestions as to what that could involve?
Ms. Frank.
To me, that's more of a federal issue than here, but I think the state needs to be aware of it. The federal government does crop insurance for farmers who have disasters in their field. I would envision some form of crop insurance for the pullets, for the birds, for the turkeys, if some program can be in place in these kind of instances, very similar to crop insurance. I can't think of anything else. I don't know if anyone else has come up with greater ideas, but that's how we protect a crop farmer from situations beyond their control so we don't lose them all.
So, Ms. Frank, thank you so much for your testimony. Like I was saying in my opening comments, around here, everybody was pulling together. This was, at least in the time that I've spent in the legislature, an outbreak like this was unprecedented in the poultry industry, right? And nothing that we've ever seen before. And everybody was coming together to do the best they possibly could with the information that they had. And with you bringing forth your testimony, it's going to be very helpful, I believe that. And we have the professionals here, others, interested stakeholders that can address some of your concerns. The industry, have you spoken to others that have been affected maybe later than what you have? Have they seen improvements, or is what you experienced common throughout?
Remember I said my outbreak was June 1st?
Yes.
There were only four after me.
Okay.
What I see part of the issue here is I think the state has a fairly decent handle on how to handle this in turkeys. I do not believe the state has a grasp on how to handle it in the big chicken complexes. It is not going well. It did not go well. You almost need somebody on staff to fight through everything and get it that it goes decent.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And during the summer, we had some regional meetings with the Council of State Governments and some of our peers and Iowa were there, and they were talking about the difficulty with chickens, and particularly with depopulating versus turkeys, that you had to deal with the pens, removing the chickens from pens. And I'm a little unclear on yours, if the pullets were out or if they were penned, or, and I know they were dealing with layers and pullets and different varieties of farms in Iowa where it was more chickens than turkeys. Do you have any, and I know that people in the industry work together and talk together, have you talked with any of your peers in Iowa about how the chickens have worked? Maybe if you can tell us a little bit about the differences between the chickens and the turkeys.
Ms. Frank.
Yes, I have talked to Iowa, partly because I'm a grower for Rembrandt Enterprises right now, and they probably are one of the biggest hit companies, you know, in the egg industry. I'm strictly a pullet grower, so for those of you who don't know what a pullet is, I get a day-old baby chick and I raise it till it's about ready to lay. My birds were all in cages, as are, I think, almost, I don't know, Steve Olson can probably answer this, almost all the chickens of that, I think the total number of chickens killed was somewhere in the neighborhood of 42 million. Almost all of them were in cages. People were allowed to bring in crews that typically work with birds. So we have crews who come and give shots, who move birds for us, who move them from my place to the laying complex. There are crews that this is their life, they do this. There are a few places, particularly in Iowa, where those crews were allowed to come and work. They went much smoother than when USDA brought in these crews that were put together to do this with no experience, no understanding of the barns, no understanding of a chicken, and no understanding of how they kill them in the kill carts.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up, I know in Iowa they were having difficulty with disposal, that they were having to truck them for landfills and composting. We've been doing that with turkeys. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how your disposal worked after they were depopulated? Did the composting work? I mean, within, I realize the infrastructure is a little bit different, but just I'm trying to get an idea of chickens versus turkeys and what happens after the depopulation.
Ms. Frank.
I have four barns, and they're on two different sites, and to get from one to the other, you have to go down a quarter mile of the county road. So we were not allowed to compost them all together. We had to do two different sites. We were not allowed to move anything on that quarter mile. On the site with the older birds that had more birds at the time, we built a compost pile on a building pad that we had sitting beside. So it was the typical layering, what you hear, of the litter in the barn. That's why we had to cut the barns open to get it out and layer with the birds in there, and wood shavings and corn stalks layered with the birds. That barn, that compost pile in 4 days was fully up to temperature, and in 2 weeks didn't have an identifiable bird in it, the one sitting out in the sun. Up in the yard where it was baby chicks, they were 3 weeks old. That one was built inside just because of the structure of how it was. That one worked very, very poorly, and we had to rebuild it at the end of 2 weeks and start it over again. It can work very well, but they have to be set up well, and they're better outside than in. That's my experience of it. I don't know if the officials would agree with that, but that was our experience. The outside one was done and over with in no time, no flies, no smell. The inside one was more of a problem.
Representative Hansen? Okay. Representative Anderson, Mark, we'll take your question, then we'll move on. We do have another producer to testify as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Ms. Frank, for coming to testify. I got the impression during your testimony that you were prevented from documenting any of this with pictures.
Ms. Frank.
We were strongly encouraged not to let any media find out what was happening out there. Tim can tell you that we didn't fully comply with that because we were having trouble with the EAW and MPDES, and we happened to get calls from state people who wanted to talk that over. So they were there some. We weren't told that we couldn't document it, but everybody wants this to go well. Everybody assumes it's going to work, and you keep your cameras put away. I won't assume that next time. I'll have the film in the can.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Follow-up. Ms. Frank, any other closing comments before we go to the next one?
I do really appreciate the opportunity to let you know what happened to us. And I also want to remind you that turkeys and chickens work very different on this, and it needs to get looked at as two different animals as you work through this and what to do in the future.
Thank you so much. Chair Anderson has one more question.
One last quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frank, you talked about your crew is depopulating at least one barn. And part of the problem, I think, when this was really going hot and heavy was the lack of foamers to do that job. So how are you able to access a foamer and do this job with your own crew on your own?
Ms. Frank.
Turkeys are foamed. Chickens are gassed. They're all in cages. You can't foam. You can't fill the whole barn with foam. These are two-story barns with the chickens on the upper floor and dry manure on the lower floor. So all the birds had to be taken out of the cages and put into a big metal cart called a CO2 cart, and they're driven to the ends of the barn where we have CO2 canisters standing and hook CO2 to the top of them and gas them and let them sit.
Anderson. All right, Ms. Frank, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
For this is very helpful. Right, enjoy the day. We'll move to Mr. Olson. Steve, you want to go next, or we also have Orson. Can we have both of you come down, if that's okay?
Barb had to leave.
Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And while they're coming up, I am going to have to leave at, because it's the first day of school, and school gets out a little bit early, but I mentioned we were at some regional meetings, and I wanted to pass out the Council of State Governments Midwest Legislative Conference passed a unanimous resolution encouraging Midwestern states and the federal government to work together. It was a bipartisan effort when we met in North Dakota, so I'm going to pass that one around.
Thank you.
And then when we met in Seattle at the National Conference of State Legislators, we also unanimously passed with all the states an avian flu research proposal. So I'm going to pass that around as well.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Make sure everybody gets a copy of that. So please state your name for the record and who you represent, and begin, please. We'd like to go first.
I'm Steve Olson. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association and Chicken and Egg Association. And I think I'm going to actually let Robert go first, and then I can kind of maybe fill in some stuff, too. So.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, representatives, for allowing us time to speak. I'm a second-generation turkey farmer. My brother and I have a breeder hen operation, so we sell hatching eggs to Wilmer Poultry Company.
If you could just state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry. Robert Orston.
All
right,
from
Wilmer, Minnesota.
Thank you.
And so my brother and I have five farms, and so we start turkeys at a day old, and then they move on up to for 15 weeks they're on that farm, 15 weeks they're in a light controlled farm, and then they would move to the egg production farms. So in April, at the end of April, we were diagnosed April 24th in our light controlled farm, and there was 18,000 breeder hens that were growing that became positive. And I guess our experience is quite different than Mrs. Frank's. You know, we our caseworker showed up on Sunday, and I went in, met with him Sunday morning. We filed the initial paperwork, and the birds were depopulated that next week, and the compost pile was built inside our barns. And you know, I guess I don't really have too much to say about that, I guess. But and then we kind of went through, and then on May 25th, Memorial Day, we got the call that our young production birds that were 9 weeks into production became positive, and that was a little more, because in those barns we have nest boxes that the turkeys can go to. Turkeys in general are free roaming within the barn, and so there's four rows of nest boxes that they can go to. But again, the caseworkers were there the next day. The birds were depopulated the following day, which was on a Wednesday, and by Saturday they were, everything was fully composted. And so from that perspective, I really, it sounds like we had vastly different experiences. So,
for your caseworker, was that USDA, the individual? Your caseworker, was it USDA provided or the Department of Ag from Minnesota here?
All of our caseworkers have been USDA until the recent one. And she is a Minnesota Board of Animal Health employee on a temporary basis. And she, by the sounds of it, she will be our caseworker through the duration of the rest.
So you talked about your experience being a little different than the earlier testifier. If there's anything that advice for us or the individuals that have been involved, is there anything that we can or should be doing different from your perspective?
You know, I think the Board of Animal Health did a very good job. Like I said, you know, this employee is on a temporary basis. You know, they just don't have the staffing to handle what went on. But I think everyone worked, like you said earlier, Mr. Chair, that everyone pulled together and did the best we could with what we knew at the time. And so, you know, on our farms, we're doing quite a bit of work on getting our facilities improved and going to go forward. We're a small family operation. We're not, we have 18 employees, and we hopefully will have a third generation coming up with our boys. But, you know, we're spending somewhere between $1.5 and $1.8 million out of our own. I mean, that's our own money that we're spending, because we hope to be in this business, be able to pass it down to the next generation. So, you know, I think from the turkey side, I can't speak to the chickens, but on the turkey side, I think everyone's just pulling themselves up and trying to move past and do the best we can going forward. So,
thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Hanson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. As we move towards fall and the fear of reintroduction of the disease, as a producer, what have you done, or what practices, or what's the change from spring to now? What are you doing as a farmer on the ground who's trying to prevent this from coming back?
Storson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanson. On our farms that we are back in production, in some downtime between flocks, we built enclosed breezeways between the barns, and so now we have a single entry. Our employees go into the first door and get dressed and prepared for the day, and there's no need to go back outside. Previously, they had to shuffle between barns to collect eggs and bring eggs back to the main collection. So that's one change that we've done. We are in the process of, we were a little bit old school. We had all manual nests, so we had to bring in bedding twice a week. We had to embed those nests. We are now, the farm that is back in production is now fully automatic, meaning there's no outside stuff coming into the barn. There is no nesting material. The nesting material is a plastic mat that the eggs are laid on. Signage, we have signage on every door, or we will have before birds come back in. We haven't had a lot of time to prepare between cleaning up and then going back to production. So, our doors will be locked from the inside, so anybody that's inside the barn will be able to get out, but outside you won't be able to get in, except for the main entrance, which will be a key pass. There's some things that we're doing.
Representative Hanson.
That's helpful, because I think as we move forward, some of the practical things that could be done, it's helpful for us to understand that and the work that's being done to prepare.
Thank you. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Orson, I think you said you have had two sites that were infected, and you have five total sites. Is that correct?
Sorry. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. Yes, that is the... So we have five farms, and we have five facilities or premises, but two of the premises we operate as one location. But for this reason, we have they're actually two separate premises. So the one premise went positive on Memorial Day. The second location, which is a quarter mile down the road, was taken because they were dangerously close. So that farm didn't actually get diagnosed as positive, but they were considered positive.
Chair Anderson.
Well, just to follow up, I guess where I was going with that was if you would have had two sites that were positive out of your total of five, you know, there's a lot of questions as to how it spread, why it spread, and I was going to ask if you had any insight into the rhyme or reason why this barn got hit, this barn didn't. Do you see any patterns emerging or that did emerge that would help us to this fall or next year slow down or stop it?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson. Our farms are very spread out. From our furthest points is about 30 miles, and so, but we are mostly in Candiahuy County, which was, hard hit in this disease outbreak. But my opinion would be the depopulation of the farms. Nobody could have expected what happened this spring, and we just weren't prepared to that level. There was a lot of talk. We knew it was coming. It came in the United States in November, but we didn't know it would come in February. From our personal standpoint, I didn't meet with my brother lives on a production farm. I live on the poult farm. We did not get together to do business until from the 1st of April to about the middle of June. We didn't go through the risk. We didn't stop. I didn't go into supply stores. I would call and say, this is what I need. Can you just put it in my truck for me? That's our experience. I don't know how much more a person could do to stop the transmission from farm to farm.
So you and your brother, even though you're business partners, you didn't even get together and meet for the fear of cross-contamination. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I actually have several family members that are cousins, brother-in-law, that are in the turkey industry. We typically have Sunday lunch at our mother's, we did not do that from April to the middle, or maybe even about the 1st of July. So, because we didn't, even though we knew everybody would shower before they came to grandma's, it just wasn't worth the risk.
Yeah, the importance of biosecurity. Mr. Olson.
Yeah, again, for the record, my name is Steve Olson. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association and the Chicken and Egg Association of Minnesota. And I echo previous comments and thank the House, the Senate, the Governor's Office for bipartisan support during the legislative session, especially towards the end. When you had a few other things to think about, we appreciate the attention that you gave to this issue by supporting the agencies and the industry through different programs. You've heard some of the financial and emotional toll, both from Barb as well as from Rob. And, I echo that's a story that is prevalent throughout all of the industry. Whether people had infected flocks or not, there was a lot of financial and emotional toll. And again, Rob talked about the investment that their farmer's making out of their pocket, plus there's a loss of income from having some downtime. And then also that Barb mentioned the lost investment that they're not going to make, at least in the foreseeable future, in that business. And so that's less Minnesota corn and soybeans that could have been fed to Minnesota poultry. And so this has had a huge ripple effect on the economic standpoint. And I guess I've got a couple of comments, but I'll help answer any questions that you may have about the response that did happen over the last several months. But I would also like to focus on kind of where we think things are going or we think things that need to go. And to that end, we're focused on a number of areas. One is biosecurity, trying to control what we can control at that barn door. I know that you guys have had plenty of discussions over the last few years about domes in Minnesota, so we're not going to talk about a dome over the state of Minnesota or over our barns. But that we understand that this is something that has been found in wild birds, but we also need to focus on what we can control. And Rob mentioned some of the practices that are going on with a number of our farms, and one of them is the Danish entry system. We're putting, when you go into an entry area, there's a physical barrier that farm employees need to take off the boots, and if they have coveralls that they wear outside, they take those off. They sit on a bench to do that. They swing their feet on the other side of the bench and put boots that are dedicated to just that barn and coveralls that are dedicated to just that barn. It's one of those physical barriers to help make sure that anything that's outside doesn't come inside. And again, there's we're talking about expanding the concrete aprons outside of the barn doors where we use to load up birds so the trucks or so that the loader doesn't have to go all the way into the barn, and that it's an easier surface to disinfect. Another area that we're looking at is research. In the University of Minnesota, the Palmer Chair in Avian Health and the College of Food, Ag, and Natural Resource Sciences has put together some proposals that they have been funded through the Rapid Ag Response Fund at the University of Minnesota. But there's also some additional funding that has come from the legislature to LCCMR and to the Department of Ag through the Ag Research Board. And so we're working together with them to put together a list of what are the research questions that need to be answered yet. And so we have a list of those. There's nothing that's finalized yet, but we're getting close to that point. And again, those are questions that are going to be important to understanding the current situation, but also helping to protect flocks down the road for high path influenza, but also give us a better understanding of how to improve our biosecurity and help with overall flock health. Wild bird surveillance is another area of focus. The University of Minnesota convened a meeting in mid-August of wild bird surveillance experts and researchers from not only Minnesota, but across the country, University of Georgia, Ohio State University, British Columbia, as well as DNR and the University of Minnesota. And that was to have a discussion, or they called it a conversation, basically find out what all of those entities are doing, and are there things that can be done differently or coordinated to help better understand what this virus is, and how does it operate in the wild birds, as well as what wild bird populations is this virus found. And so there's coordination happening there. And there's still, I think, more work that needs to be done to get a better understanding. And it's not one of these things where, we know that it's in the wild birds, but it's no one's one fault. But we need to better understand how that virus acts in the wild birds to give us a better sense of what the prevalence may be this fall and next spring and fall of 2016. To again, better know what to expect. And and then a fourth area is response. And ultimately, again, what both Barb and Rob have mentioned is that the response to this virus, we need, we've learned a lot, and again, it was a coordinated effort, but we need to get better at that. Basically, when the virus is found, we need to put those flocks down quicker. And so the state, the governor's office has taken lead with the agencies on purchasing some foamers, which would help in the turkey situation, also looking at some carbon dioxide technologies that doing some research on those. But again, as Barb mentioned, in the layer industry, it's a different ballgame because of the way the birds or way the barns are constructed. CO2 is the predominant method, but part of the issue that we had is that those birds weren't euthanized quick enough, and we need to do a better job with that. And those are conversations that the Board of Animal Health and that the State Department of Ag and USDA are having. But that's one of the keys to being able to respond to this in the future if we do have further introductions. In industry, we understand that we have a big role in this, and so we have had some meetings with CEOs and animal health lead staff from all the poultry companies in Minnesota. We've had, I think, four of them. where we are putting together a prevention and control plan specific to each of those industry segments. And again, as was pointed out, is that, you know, the layer is different than turkey and it's different than broiler. And so each of those segments said, you know, right, how are we going to keep this virus out in the first place? But if we do get it, what's our plan to react to this and to control it and eradicate it? And so that's, you know, we're in the process of finalizing those plans. And again, those are something, there's going to be industry initiatives that those that the industry will incorporate into our plan of action. So we'll have a peacetime that, you know, basically is, you know, things are normal. There's no virus around. And we'll have an alert status that it's this time of year, starting September 1st to December 1st, where there is a higher awareness of the potential for high path avian influenza. And then we'll have a what we're calling a wartime. Basically, if the virus has been found, there's a different level of activity that we have to, and it's from a bird surveillance to biosecurity to a number of different functions. You know, and again, the lessons learned are that we need to depopulate quicker. Case managers, again, has been pointed out that that a lot of the case managers were USDA, and this is, you know, this is part of the way the system is and was, is that those people would be here for 3 weeks and then they would rotate out, and they come from all across the country. A lot of them didn't have poultry background, so they were learning as they were going, and they would advise a farmer of one thing, and then they would rotate out, and the next person would come in and have a different perspective on it. And so I think consistency with case managers, and our recommendation is that those case managers be state of Minnesota people, Board of Animal Health people, and if a farm goes positive, that they get a case manager, and that's the person that they work with all the way throughout this whole system. I think there's going to be more consistency that would be, again, you know, a better response to this overall situation. And then the other comment I'm hearing from people, and again, you know, both Barb and I think Rob have alluded to it, is that the amount of paperwork that goes with this. I mean, we all need to be accountable for where money is, public money is spent. But I think that there's things that can be streamlined. And again, USDA has heard that message. They're working on it, and we'll need to continue to work through that overall system. And then finally, I think, again, the other piece that came through the legislature, we appreciate the approval for the bonding and the expansion of the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. That will give us the ability to be better prepared to deal with, again, not only this type of a situation, but any kind of an animal disease threat that we have down the road, by just having a better capability and having it spread out, so that we've got the diagnostic lab at the University of Minnesota, but we also have a remote location in Wilmer, or at least an outstate location that can help carry some of the load too. So with that, those are my comments.
Mr. Olson, we heard two very different perspectives, and I think you summed it up well, but do you think it was mainly because of the type of poultry? We heard the perspective from the turkey grower, which seemed to have gone pretty well, and the perspective from Ms. Frank. Do you think that was the main reason behind the very difference?
Not necessarily. I think that the type of poultry, you know, the difference is that the magnitude of what needs to be done on a layer or a pullet farm, there's a lot more people that need to be involved in that, and so that the crews are a lot larger. You know, turkey farms would have USDA crews come in to do the cleaning and disinfecting and some of those, and we had, again, there was issues with that whole process. But I do think that I lost my train of thought. The situation that happened with the pullet connection, there's a number of wrong things that happened at the wrong time to kind of make that, to exasperate how that normally would have been. But I think that when you're bringing crews in from outside that don't have that ability, don't have an understanding of how to deal with livestock, it does cause some issues that shouldn't be there, that don't need to be there.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Olson. In listening about what we do in the future and hearing talk about insurance or whenever there's public money being spent for private industry, I think questions get raised about what's the public response. And I think emergency response, you see a broad support for emergency response because the state has a role in protecting public health and protecting the economy and providing for research. If we get into covering loss, with an insurance program or either a federal or a state program, is there something that the industry would see as like best practices certification, or what's part of the deal that comes with coverage? Where, because there's a lot of unintended consequences if you're going to cover things, and particularly when we're dealing with livestock. So have you thought about, or has the producer thought about, any best practices certification, biosecurity certification, some type of preventive practices that we've talked, the testifiers have talked about implementing, so that if there is going to be the public investment, it doesn't happen over and over and over again, that there is some management practices that the public dollar has some assurance of implementing to reduce future cost, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, yeah, I think I do understand what you're saying. You're basically asking, what are we going to do to help make sure that this reduces the cost to the public? And USDA was directed through the Farm Bill to investigate a catastrophic disease loss insurance program in poultry, and I also believe in swine. And so they went through and had some listening sessions. They've gathered some information, and so we'll have to see how that comes. But for the most part, you know, the industry would be paying premiums to access that insurance program, but it also is going to depend on what it ends up covering as to how attractive it's going to be to growers. We've already started with, you know, just a whole education process on biosecurity practices. You know, these are things that the industry knew, the growers know anyway, and have done. But it's been an accelerated focus on what those practices are, if there's anything, new technologies out there, but also, you know, the training throughout their whole system so that everybody understands what it takes. And I think that as we move forward, that's going to be that's going to be key to making sure everybody understands this. And unfortunately, we still don't have a silver bullet that says if we did this practice, that this would ensure that we're going to be able to keep this virus up, because this is so different than anything that we've ever seen before. And so we're looking at a combination of things, and that's where, again, where the research is going to help us better understand this virus better and hopefully figure out some of those ways. But again, our focus has been controlling what we can control, and we know that if we need to focus on that barn door and try to keep the virus out from there through doing a number of different things.
There's a Hansen follow-up. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Olson, Mr. Arson, for coming here. Just a couple quick questions, but I do want to mention that I had the pleasure of knowing both of the people that are here today from the industry, and I think I say that because I think it's important to understand that when we talk about all these things at this level, we talk about numbers and the scope and stuff like that, but these are real people's lives and real people in the industry, so I appreciate your willingness to come out here and give what you experienced. A real simple question. I'd like to ask kind of two parts to the role of private industry on the depopulation and cleanup, and along with their input on how to do things better, do things different. Is it important, the first question is it important for private industry, the private people, to have, to be involved in this and have the input? And then the second would be, what level of input were you able to have, what level of acceptance in you being involved in the actual process of doing the depop and cleanup that you have? What did you experience?
Mr. Orse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller, the depopulation, we didn't have a whole lot of input into that. That was a USDA crew, that contracted crew that came in and did that service. They also did the composting, which there was a little bit of confusion in the beginning as to if the private farmer could do that or not. But once the composting was done, our crews did everything as far as cleanup goes. And our caseworker would come in when we'd call them and say, can you come and check and see what kind of progress, if we're on the right track. And so the first two activities were pretty much out of our hands, but then the rest was all our own crew handling the cleanup.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, in your opinion, if something in the future were to happen, would you see value in private industry having a stronger hand in the work that needs to be done?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, that is that's part of the discussion that we've been having. And actually, we started discussions early on, or you know, about a quarter of the way through this process, where we would have industry. It was primarily veterinarians, industry veterinarians, and myself meet three times a week with the incident commanders and other key people from the Board of Animal Health, USDA, and the State Department of Agriculture. And it was a way to deal with those kind of things, that we've had something, we had some issue with composting, can we shorten the time frame because we're hitting the heat cycles and those kind of things. And so we would have discussions about that. And so this stuff did evolve over time. And I think that's one of the things that we need to talk further about. What is industry capable of doing that can assist with this process while still maintaining the role that the government has as far as oversight and making sure that, again, that we're dealing with this from an animal health and a public health perspective.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson, we're going to move on to the next testifiers here at the bottom of the hours.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kind of along that same line, Mr. Olson, you mentioned case managers being more vocal, or maybe Board of Animal Health folks. To get to that, would that take USDA writing off on that part, or could the state do that without the approval of USDA?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, that's a question that's probably better asked to Dr. Hartman when he testifies. But my understanding is that the state can do that, because ultimately, I'm stepping a little bit on the edge of my knowledge here, but that my understanding is that the state invited USDA in, and so the state was in control of the response to this ultimately. But that's one of the roles that USDA has played or could play, and so that's why the case managers fell more within their bailiwick. And it wasn't strictly, but for the most part, majority of the case managers were USDA folks. But some of the district vets for Board of Animal Health did do that as well.
Thank you. We just Representative Fabian. Can you hear us? You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. For Mr. Olson, are you making some plans? I heard you kind of allude to it a little bit, to sit down with the growers who've been impacted by this, and even the growers who have not directly been impacted but are taking steps to try to prevent some of this stuff. Are you planning any kind of debriefing session with growers and the Department of Ag and the Board of Animal Health and the Diagnostic Lab and USDA to kind of maybe lay out a chart of path for the future, best how to deal with these things, kind of the best management practices, ideas?
So, Mr. Olson, do we have any type of grower outreach to help educate and the growers so that they can prepare themselves for potentially future outbreaks?
Chairman Hamilton and Representative Fabian, yeah, we've had outreach throughout this whole process. Back in July, USDA and the U.S. Poultry and Egg Association, which is a national organization, convened a lessons learned conference in Des Moines, Iowa, and we presented a number of different people with experience in the Minnesota situation presented there. And we've got outreach to our growers. We're going through an education review process now with growers, and the priority has been those growers that had infected flocks. And we'll summarize those discussions and then get that out to our broader membership so that they can benefit from the lessons that each of those farms learned throughout this process. As far as a large scale discussion with the Board of Animal Health and Department of Ag and others. We don't have any big meeting planned, but we have constant meetings and constant conference calls with the agencies on and where we're at now, but where do we need to go? And again, that gets back to the purchase or the manufacture of foamers to prevent or to be able to respond in the future. And those kind of discussions are happening every week.
Right. Thank you. Representative Fabian, do you have a follow-up?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I'm curious to know, after hearing Ms. Frank and her situation and the concerns that she expressed, two things related to that. The delay in the notification from the diagnostic lab, was that ever resolved? I think by and large, from the contact that I've had with people involved with this, things went pretty well under the circumstances. But there seems to be something different with the Frank operation. Can somebody answer that for me?
So the question is about the delay to notify Ms. Frank. Would you be able to address that, Mr. Olson, or should we save that for the next?
Maybe so. To my knowledge, I believe that when she testified, she said she had not, she still had not received that notification from them. But I'm not close enough to that.
So Representative Fabian, we're going to wait until the next people come up here. They'd be better suited to answer that question. Do you have another question for the testifiers?
Real quickly.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Fabian.
I'm curious to know, with regards to that, and there being USDA involvement, maybe Mr. Olson can answer this. What type of communications, contact have they had with our Washington delegation, and what response have they gotten from them with regards to some of the issues regarding USDA?
So, excuse me, Representative Fabian, so would that be a question to USDA? Because we do have them here to testify as well.
Okay, it could be, but I'm also curious to know, I'm sure that Mr. Olson has had contact with our Washington delegation, legislators, senators, and congressmen there in Washington, D.C., what their response has been to him with regards to their communications to USDA.
Mr. Olson, you're working with our congressional delegation, and as far as their interaction, not only with producers, but with USDA as well. You want to comment on that?
Yep. Chairman Hamilton and Representative Fabian, yes, we've worked very closely, and they've been actively engaged. They reach out to us to see how things are going. You know, both U.S. senators and primarily Congressman Peterson, because his district is the largest turkey-producing district in the country, and just his position on the Ag Committee, he's been a great resource and has had conversations both with the chief veterinarian, John Clifford, as well as with Secretary Vilsack.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to move to Mr. Cruz. You want to make your way down here? Thank you so much for the testifiers. Mr. Cruz, you want to help us navigate through our next testifiers, if you would, please? I believe we do have a member from the USDA. Is that who we're going to bring up first?
Mr. Chair and members, Sandra Cruz, Minnesota Department of Ag, also representing the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Yes, you're correct. We have with us from the USDA Dr. Steve Halstead, who will be going first just to give kind of a national picture of the avian influenza outbreak, which the nation experienced this past year. And then from there, we'll transition into the state perspective as you mentioned, Chair, kind of past, present, and future, where we're at, where we're going, and we'll kind of go from there. So with that, I would turn it over to Dr. Halstead.
Dr. Halstead, please state your name for the record and who you represent and begin, please.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you this afternoon. I'm Dr. Steve Halstead. I'm a veterinarian with USDA's Veterinary Services, and I serve as the director for District 3 of Veterinary Services, which is the Midwestern District of 8 states but includes Iowa and Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to respond to some of the questions that have been, or comments that have been made already, but I also wanted to provide just a little bit of background. I think from what I've heard, it's not necessary to run through the numbers and that sort of background, because it seems everybody's very well versed on what happened and the scale of it. And in fact, that's my first point. This is the largest animal disease response that U.S. citizens have ever mounted. And the impact, of course, is yet being tabulated. When USDA became involved, it was done with plans and practices and principles that had been developed in other outbreaks and other experiences, but nothing of the magnitude and scale. And so it was very much a learning experience every step of the way as we tried what we had done before, what had worked, and what had been put in place, and discovered that those things weren't necessarily up to the challenge. And so, really, to cut to the chase, there were a lot of things that were tried, a lot of practices that didn't really reflect the size of the challenge and the magnitude. And we've learned a lot from that. I've heard it said many times today that there have been lessons learned, and that certainly is the case. And that's continuing. I think most of you probably are aware that Secretary Vilsack has called for essentially a rewriting of the response plan, and has asked John Clifford, Dr. Clifford was mentioned earlier, and others in the agency to gather comments and information through feedback sessions and work groups to put together a fall response plan, and that is in draft form right now, and actually it's in the second version of draft form as that information continues to flow in, and as we hear from the likes of Ms. Frank and Mr. Olson and the industry members across the country who have been impacted, but primarily here in the Midwest, of course. The concerns certainly about the delays in monies being paid are of great concern, a great impact on the producers. And while there are practices that are not necessarily the control of the Department of Agriculture, those comments have been heard, and modifications are being made to try to expedite that process. And I think we'll see if there is another outbreak, and we all anticipate that there will be, that those contracts will flow much more quickly. There'll be a much more standardized process for developing the funding pictures and getting that money out there. So that's an important point of work that's ongoing at this point. The issues about who does what and how things are done are also being developed and discussed. Just for one point of understanding, the response that USDA mounts is in most cases, and I won't say this is exclusive, but in most cases is in response to an invitation by the state to come in and assist with the response, and then once that happens, the partnership between the state animal health agency and the Department of Agriculture is critical to how that functions, and I think in most cases you would have seen and you will see that the that partnership, it's very difficult to tell who's whom, because the overlap and the interchangeability that allows us to provide the expertise, get people in the right place, and get the resources where they need to be, doesn't depend on the agency. It depends on the people themselves, and it depends on who has control of the resources. Having said that, I think the point that's been made about some of the critical parts of that response, the people really, those case managers, and a parallel, the persons who work with the producers to develop the contracts for reimbursement, it is important that there be consistency there. I think Dr. Hartman will maybe comment on this, but certainly in our discussions, I know we share the opinion that unless you look at the license plate on the vehicle, you don't have any real sense of gauging whether a person who pulls up in the driveway who says they're from the Department of Agriculture is really with the U.S. Department of Agriculture or really the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Our field staff are that interchangeable and that well paired up and lined up to know all of the work in the state. And it's that way pretty much across the country. So I think the question about those case managers being local folks, really don't think that it matters whether it's a local USDA person or a local Board of Animal Health person, but I think that there will be an understanding of the importance of that person being a local person and not having the turnover that we typically get with the incident management teams as people are coming in from across the country and rolling through those positions. We in fact did that with our cooperative agreement case persons, where we recognized that changing people on a three-week schedule really was setting us way back, and it wasn't helpful, and it wasn't helping to build trust in the system. And so we established a single person to serve as that financial case manager for all of the cases in Minnesota and likewise in Iowa. And that expedited the process and provided consistency and reduced the level of stress considerably. So there's some history, there's some precedent, and I think that that message has been heard. likewise, Secretary Vilsack and Dr. Clifford have heard the other messages about the problems that were out there. Again, a lot of it based on scale, but that doesn't serve as an excuse. It's just to reference that this is huge, and we all have to work together to make it work. Mr. Chairman, you've made that statement in your opening comments, and I think while we overcame an awful lot, there are still things we need to learn and responses that we need to put together. It's an ongoing process as the call response, as we're calling it, is more fully developed. And I can speak for Dr. Clifford and Secretary Vilsack when I say that they're all ears and they want to hear, continue to hear, the messages from industry as, again, we prepare for what might be the next round and keep the industry healthy. So with that, I'd like to respond to any questions if there may be.
Thank you, Dr. Halstead. And I guess a question and a comment. First of all, you're right. We are all in this together, and everybody's doing the best that they possibly can with the information that is before us. And we continue to address any shortfalls that we may have. My question would be, in the case of Ms. Frank, is there a hotline or something that she could call in order to get, or any producer that is not getting their questions answered or having a difficult time, is there somebody that they could call basically, if they're not getting the answer through the case manager, to where they can go to somebody else that can help them? And secondly, what I'd like is some ownership, not as far as what went wrong, but what we're going to do right moving forward. When I say that is, can we get somebody, a name, a number, whatever, to where we can get that back to Ms. Frank and other producers that contact us and say, this is the individual that you can get a hold of to help you out currently to get, you know, to answer your questions?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. Good to see you all again.
Welcome.
We do, in fact, have a hotline that's on our website, and that's to answer questions like that. Ms. Frank, it was either her or her daughter called me directly, and that's when we reassigned a Board of Animal Health case manager to the case because it wasn't going well. So, yes, we have that covered. And your other question was?
You answered both of them. Okay. One was, do we have the hotline, which we want to make sure we got that on record. And secondly, it was having an individual to go back and make sure that, in this case, Ms. Frank, her questions and concerns are answered. And what you're saying is someone through the Department of Animal Health or Board of Animal Health is currently assigned to that, and, yes, that's the direction. So with that, in particular case, if I have any questions, I can call you, right, Dr. Hartman and others. All right. Thank you.
I'll give you my home phone number.
Yeah, I think I have it.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, yes. I don't know the specifics of Ms. Frank's the problems that she encountered, and Dr. Hartman and I have not spoken about it because we just both heard it. I heard it for the first time in the hearing here. But I'll confer with Dr. Hartman, and I'll promise to either myself or through Bill, follow up to the two concerns that I'm related, the notification of the disease, the confirmation, and where the money is. So
thank you.
I'll take that and work with Bill to get an answer back to her.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Miller, you have a question.
Mr. Chair, no, only question just to kind of fill in since Ms. Franks is not here. I've talked with the family quite a bit, and I think what Dr. Hartman did say is correct that once they brought in the site supervisor from the Board of Animal Health, things she would say that things went very well once that got going.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Miller. Any other questions for the testifiers? Any other questions? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir Halstead, again, going back to the first testifier, what surprised me was when she said Thursday noon, 40 hours, during the height of the depopulation, the crews evidently took the rest of the week off. Was that standard operating procedure, or explain how that would ever happen during the height of this outbreak?
Dr. Halstead.
Mr. Chairman, it's true that many of the operatives that did the work on the farms, the cleaning and disinfection, the depopulation, the composting, were contract employees, the terms of those contracts then dictated the hourly wages, the overtime, and those parameters of how the employees of those companies who were the contract companies operated. That was a problem early on. I can confirm that we had issues in that direction. Later in the response, we were able to renegotiate those contracts or work with different companies who could pay, and we would authorize the paying of overtime or paying of for more than 40 hours a week. So, again, it's one of those things that we identified early and recognized, and changes were made. And I won't say that was necessarily always the case in Minnesota. As you are aware, more of the later cases occurred in Iowa, and that's where some of those changes were implemented. One thing that we do have to keep in mind is, as we got into the summer and the heat and humidity of the summer, we did have to be concerned about the health of those workers, and they're working in personal protective equipment, so they're wearing masks and hoods and coveralls and boots and gloves and all that. Making sure that they stayed sound and healthy was also of significant concern, and so the breaks that were necessary to allow them out of the houses to get some fresh air, to get hydration, those sorts of things, that has to be built into it as well. All that means is we just have to make sure that we've got sufficient people so that we can account for that sort of protection of the employees at the same time we get the job done.
Thank you. Jerry Anderson. Any other questions, members? Thus far, any other questions? Thank you, Dr. Halstead. For yourself, I think you may have to be leaving as well. No, or can you stick around for a little bit?
I have a little bit of time.
Okay, so in case we have additional questions that pop up. So, all right, thank you. Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Chair and members, Dr. Hartman's getting his presentation booted up here. I thought I'd just give a little brief overview on some of the things that I'm covered and what MDA has done as a response. And maybe just as a good reminder, just as far as the state structure goes, I know it can get a little bit foggy, but as you recall, it is the Board of Animal Health carries the statutory authority in this area. They're the lead state agency. And then MDA has an MOU and a supporting role with the Board of Animal Health. And we've worked very closely with Mr. Olson and members of the USDA and industry. And just by way of example on that, we have heard loud and clear from industry on the issue of foamers and response. And as you said, this was a group effort. And with your authorship and support and the governor's signature, a significant amount of money was put forth towards these efforts. Currently, MDA is contracting for 4 additional foamers in addition to the one that we have. Once we hit the marketplace, as you can imagine, we weren't the only people looking or shopping for foamers. There really were none to buy, and that was the case during the end of session when we were looking to purchase what we could then. So we're actually, I believe, having these built off the raw plans to make sure that we are getting these as fast as humanly possible. With regard to just the number of people that have been involved in talking about overtime, Chair Anderson, the department put in just in overtime hours close to 8,000 overtime hours. 18,000 staff hours were used up and invested in the avian and flu response. I think it's 18,424 hours of MDA staff time were put out in the field on avian influenza, which if you just think about how many people that would be an entire FTE for a year, that's a significant number of people invested at the height of the crisis. With all of the response combined, there was up to 520 people in the field at any given time, about 88 to 100 from MDA and BAH. So, you know, obviously there are always counterexamples and pains, but I do think that your characterization that we were all in this together, really like a 911 service for this number one industry that we have and want to preserve, I think that was the case and will continue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cruz. And in my comments, I said something to the effect, I don't want to look back and have you take responsibility for looking back. And what I meant was, everybody's taking responsibility for it. What I meant was, we don't want to place blame, right? We're all in this together. We're navigating through with the information that we have in front of us. And then what are we going to do going forward? One of the questions that I do have, maybe Dr. Hartman will answer this in your presentation, otherwise Dr. Halstead, is everything that we've learned from this, how can we replicate the process or duplicate the process to no matter what emerging disease that we're talking about? So if that will be addressed as we're doing your presentation.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, appreciate the question. That is a good point that needs to be made, that it shouldn't really matter what the disease is. There are specifics, of course, with any disease pathogen, but on the whole, the response should be as efficient and effective regardless of what that disease is. That the specifics change, but the goal is the same, and the method of reaching that goal should be the same. That's a function that USDA Veterinary Services is building into its responses through our emergency coordinator, and there are several people that fall into that role at different levels under Dr. Clifford in the country, but it's one of acute interest, and I think we will see as we move through this process, learning what we can learn from this, how to make that better for whatever the response might be, through exercises, through the feedback that we get, through new technologies that come along, partnerships with the industry, partnerships with our state colleagues, and with other departments as well, health department, natural resources, etc., to bring all of the right players to those discussions so that we can mount the response as quickly as possible and be as effective as possible. So I don't have a firm, solid, this is what we'll do, but the point is that it's recognized as critical to success regardless of what the particular challenge might be.
Thank you. Dr. Hartman.
Well, again, good afternoon, everybody. I thought I would summarize what happened this spring with our outbreak, and I don't say outbreak very easy. When we had TB, I always called it an event, but this was truly an outbreak and taxed everybody involved. It was a good example of teamwork, as you've mentioned before. The Board of Animal Health is the lead state agency for animal diseases. But as I've told everybody before, we're 50 people, and as a matter of fact, I think we're down to about 40 before this started, and have a $5 million budget. So we needed a lot of help, and we got it. The federal government provided about $70 million in indemnity for the birds that were put down or died from this disease in Minnesota. And at one point, there were 140 USDA employees here, or I should say federal employees, here in Minnesota working on this event. So they were an incredible help. I'm a little reluctant to call in USDA assets because we know the people here in Minnesota, and we like local people working on it, but it quickly got to the point where even Minnesota couldn't manage the event. As far as the state government contributions, as Santos said, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture provided an incident command team. They also provided a lot of very experienced employees, and they were a big part of the response. The Minnesota Department of Health provided monitoring of the people that were on these farms so that if there was any chance that this virus would start affecting people, we would know about that. The DNR did and is doing surveillance on the wild birds to track where this virus is. Excuse me. The Department of Public Safety activated the State Emergency Operations Center, which, when the governor declared an emergency, then allowed the Board of Animal Health to tap into any of the resources within the state. And the governor and you provided us with the funding that was necessary to be able to mount this attack. The National Guard at one point provided us with some trucks that were big enough to haul water to these sites where we were doing the foaming. And Minnesota Management and Budget was involved in helping us with contracts and purchasing. So we appreciate all that help from state government. And then from local government, we used the Emergency Operations Center's in Candiohi County and Stearns County to be able to have a site that was close to where the work was being done for an emergency operations center. And lastly, the poultry industry and the poultry producers provided guidance to us on how we should manage this, and then they were also directly involved in managing it on their farms. With that, I will turn over to my slides. This is actually two presentations you're getting today, so you're in. Tell me if you want me to shorten it.
We want you to shorten it.
You want it?
We have 35 minutes, Doc.
35 minutes. I'll do the best I can.
Total.
Well, maybe I should shorten it then. I'll skip that part of it. This outbreak was particularly devastating for the poultry industry, and the first case we had, which was kind of unusual, was March 5th. The lakes were all frozen over, the rivers were all frozen over, and there weren't many wild waterfowl around, but that's when it started. And as people have mentioned before, we haven't had a case since June 5th, which has given us the opportunity to catch up. In all, we had 110 sites under quarantine in 23 counties. At this point, all the control zones around those affected farms have been released, so we no longer have to permit birds and eggs and that sort of thing out of these areas. 92 sites have completed cleaning and disinfection, and 77 are eligible to restock. So we've made, with this break, we've made a good deal of progress. Overall, in the whole event, 9 million birds were destroyed or died of this disease, and that's the indemnity the federal government paid. Our response to this outbreak was mammoth. It was a bit overwhelming because I had always envisioned when I took this job that I and the Board of Animal Health would be responsible for all this stuff. Well, I found out we're not, and that there's plenty of help out there, so it was good that we had it. We needed that support to be successful in getting rid of the disease. And I would say especially to the poultry producers for their cooperation in a very difficult time for them. And USDA and MDA too, as I mentioned before, for supplying as many employees as they did. We've been preparing for an event like this for about 15 years. We've worked directly with the poultry industry and with USDA on those preparations. And I think that those preparations gave us a framework to manage this event. The framework wasn't what it will be next time, but it was there and it guided us through what we needed to do. I think it was a well-coordinated and effective response. So what are we going to do for this fall to change things? We're prepared for seeing this disease this fall. We have secured a facility in Wilmer for the Emergency Operations Center. We've identified the initial responders and have a plan on how to scale up if it becomes more serious. We have well-trained personnel now. Everybody at the Board of Animal Health and many of the people at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture understand this disease, understand the poultry industry better, and will be prepared. We have adequate options now for depopulation so that our goal is to be able to depopulate all of these farms within 24 to 48 hours. We've done a little bit of looking into whole house carbon dioxide as a method so that we're quicker on the layer operations. We have the equipment that's necessary. USDA is in the process of streamlining detection, appraisal, and cleaning and disinfecting, and you could ask Dr. Halstead where they're at with that, but those were some of the points during the response that were slow, so we're looking at trying to fix that. We've contracted with poultry veterinarians to do biosecurity reviews on farms, and that's in the process right now. We think that's probably the most important thing that we can do at this point is figure out ways that we could keep the virus initially from getting into a poultry farm. If we can do that, I think we'll have a lot less problems with the disease. We will assign permanent case managers from the state of Minnesota if this occurs again. We have a system in place now to do permitting of poultry and poultry products out of these control zones, and we have honed it a lot better than when we first started, so it's working pretty effectively. And I don't believe that sort of thing has ever been done before in any of these events. It's kind of a new thing for us, but thank goodness that we were as far along in planning for that as we were, because if you had to shut down any business within those control zones, this could have been a lot worse. The Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, this may answer somebody's question, they have hired additional staff and are ready to do evening and weekend work if this happens again. And thanks to all of you, we have adequate funding so that at this point we can manage another outbreak either this fall or in the spring. Mr. Chair, that's my report.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. And Representative Fabian, one of his questions was about the delay from the diagnostic lab to notify the first testifier that came here. Can you, do you have any insight on that? Can you provide an answer for Representative Fabian?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I don't really know what happened there. I believe the process was the results are at the laboratory. They report them to the case manager, and the case manager should have talked to them about it. I am not sure with the way we were submitting if the sample, if the report went to the owners or not. I'd have to check on that for you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hartman. So, any other questions for the testifier, Dr. Hartman? Any other questions? Dr. Hartman, I just want to say thank you. As well. I mean, I was talking to folks outside of Minnesota that was seeing the value in what you bring and your staff brings. Thank you for that. Any other questions for Dr. Hartman? Anything else in the presentation?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I think before I turned over to the DNR, and then I believe you have the University of Minnesota as well, I'd like to go through just a little accounting of the money that was appropriated, what's been used, and what's left over. For the AI appropriations that were made this past year. Commissioner Myron Franz is here if you have specific questions, but this information will be available to you all in a one-pager form, but I just want to kind of hit the highlights. So overall, the general fund appropriations from the past session were $7.362 million. Of that, $1.358 were expended since it's been appropriated. Now, some of that money, as you recall, Mr. Chair, was for fiscal year 14. So the vast majority of this money we're talking is available until 2017, the end of this biennium. However, there was that that stopgap money, basically, that needed to get us through the end of this past fiscal year. Of the money that we requested, the $514,000, only $40,000 is left. So that was the right amount of money to address that situation. Within the Board of Animal Health, similarly, there was about $400,000 was used. We have $1.451 left. Some of these numbers are going to, you know, kind of wash over you, but I think what the to look through all of the numbers and to see the story they tell is that, you know, in the middle of the crisis, we were asked in very, very short order fashion to come up with real numbers that were going to get us through to 2017. Through review of the numbers, it looks like we do have the funds needed to be able to address this without without needing new appropriations, barring some unforeseen spike in either cases or workload or types of procedure. The Rural Finance Authority has already sent out $647,000 in loans to industry through applications, and that's in spite of the fact that we don't have a silver bullet yet. As you recall, we modified the Rural Finance Authority to be able to use that money to both repopulate and do biosecurity measures. Well, the biosecurity measures are still somewhat of a question mark as far as what is going to be the optimal use or investment to address biosecurity on the farm. So having $647,000 out in just this number of months is a good indication that was a good investment. I can take questions, and certainly Commissioner Franz is here to get into the nitty-gritty details of all of the different lines of funding, but it is a good picture. I think it's a responsible picture, and we look to be good stewards of the public dollar that you've all entrusted us with to address this crisis.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. And I know we also have members from the Public Safety, Department of Public Safety and Department of Health in the audience as well, in case members have any questions specifically for them. But, Mr. Cruz, you said you do have a handout for us on the numbers?
Yep.
So can we get that to all the members, or do we have that?
I can work with Mr. Mark Nisley, and we'll get it to him.
Okay. Get that. Any other questions? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hartman, you mentioned in your words that we understand the disease better now than a year ago. Again, looking back, I guess, 110 sites. Were you surprised at the scope of the outbreak, and do we really know how and why it spread so fast, so widely in the upper Midwest? What's your best guess on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't think we have to guess. There was an epidemiologic study, well, several of them done, and the indication is that early on the infection was just point sources. It would be that there were wild waterfowl that were carrying this virus, and it was in the environment, and it would get into an individual barn. That was early on. Later in the response, there was evidence of lateral spread. The viruses were no longer different. There were clusters of viruses that were the same. And so the lateral spread, we can only hypothesize how that happened, but that would more than likely be either the wind or people or machinery or something like that that was spreading the disease.
Chair Anderson.
Well, just a quick follow-up. Thanks, Mr. Chair. The first outbreak was on the 5th of May, and I assume there's an incubation period, so that would push the infection date back, I assume, back into February. Not a lot of wild birds around here in February. Again, the question, why so early and out there in the middle of the prairie?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think you should, if Dr. Helverson testifies, I think you should ask him that question. He's an expert in avian influenza and has been doing it for quite some time. But our only hypothesis is it was there from the fall.
Right. So would this be a good time? Bring up individuals from the U?
We're complete, so if Dr. Helston wants to come down to answer that question, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony and for all that you do. Greatly appreciate it. Mr. Cruz, don't go too far.
I never do. You never do.
So if we can have Dr. Halverson come down, please, from the University of Minnesota. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and if you could answer Chair Anderson's question, that would be great.
My name is Dave Halverson. I'm from the University of Minnesota, where I'm a retired professor. I worked there from 1978 until about 7 years ago as a professor, extension veterinarian, and a researcher, and yes, I did do a fair amount of research in avian influenza.
Welcome.
Thank you. Do you want me to go directly to the question, and I can just say, we don't actually know the answer?
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Anderson.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. This disease hit the West Coast, November of last year, and it really got here, I think, quicker than a lot of us thought it would. Talk about the disease and how it spread so quickly, and and what you expect, I guess.
Doctor.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chairs. So I am here mostly because the Pomeroy chair holder, who Dr. Carol Cardona, could not make it because she's out of the country. She is quite familiar with both the West Coast and with avian influenza. When this hit in British Columbia and then Oregon, Washington, California, she immediately told everybody here in Minnesota, you know, all the poultry vets and so on, it'll be here by April, okay? She was adamant. Of course, we pointed out to her that she was wrong by a month, but most of the rest of the influenza people did not, you know, believe it would come. And I would say most of the influenza people that I've talked to are certainly unsure as to how it ended up in that first farm. I think they got sick on February 27th. I have yet to hear anyone explain, you know, where that might have come from.
So, Jerry Anderson. Well, thank you, Dr. Halverson. And there's, just for the record and everything, the University of Minnesota continues to do research on this, around this, seeking answers, clarification. Is this correct?
The state of Minnesota, because of its poultry industry and its 10,000 lakes and its wild waterfowl population, has been known in the rest of the country as the avian influenza capital of the country. We've documented more cases of low pathogenic avian influenza in Minnesota than probably have occurred in all the rest of the country put together. So the fact that it came to Minnesota is not at all unusual. But as Dr. Hartman said, the magnitude, okay, of these index cases, okay, these cases that came directly from waterfowl into turkey populations is unprecedented. By my guesstimate, in the states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, okay, we had about 35 index cases, okay, that came directly from waterfowl. And so if you actually look at what happened, there weren't that many. If you average it out, a total of 100 and some total cases and divide it by 35, okay, you only get, on the average, only 3 secondary cases, or the horizontal transmission was not, on the average, it was not as great as maybe you would even expect. And that's contrasted in Iowa, where almost the opposite happened. They only had 2 or 3 primary introductions, index cases in the state of Iowa, and they had about, you know, 70 total farms. So it was almost entirely lateral spread in Iowa. Probably can't guess the reason for that either, but that's the difference. So I want to say a few things then about what's been. Other question?
Could you please speak a little more directly into the mic? The folks on the phone are having a little difficult time. Thank you.
So the things that have been going on, we're fortunate in that that Dr. Cardona is probably the single most widely known influenza researcher at the University of Minnesota. She has an international reputation, and as a matter of fact, she's out of the country today talking about influenza. But some of the things that went on, you know, in her group were she initiated a communicators group. Okay, this is prior to the introduction. So by the end of December last year, she initiated a group of people. She got communicators from large poultry companies, from state agencies, and from the university, different areas in the university, to start planning for the introduction of this disease. She coordinated periodic meetings of poultry veterinarians. Again, prior to the introduction of this disease, she was meeting with these people about every 2 weeks. She also, because she had worked on environmental testing for a different virus in the past, avian pneumovirus, she immediately began validating a test of the environment, okay, in this case, the test of water for the presence of avian influenza virus, so that by the time the outbreak started, she was able to provide producers and poultry veterinarians the ability to test their environment for the virus. So at the McRock station. Some of you may be familiar with that. She ran over 7,000 tests with a pretty much of a shoestring budget and two technicians working 7 days a week. As a result of the samples that were run in that laboratory, she and along with the other poultry vets in the state were able to document the impact of the success in depopulating a farm within 24 to 48 hours versus the failure of not getting it depopulated for 7 to 14 days, and that the environmental contamination that's left when those birds are dead is about 10,000 to 100,000 times greater if those birds are not immediately killed. So we knew that if the birds weren't immediately killed, that they were excreting virus, but what we got from this was actually able to document it. And so you can hold up a number like 100,000 times worse, and it gets people's attention. And so because of that information, when USDA held their meeting in Des Moines, one of the key plans that came out of that was a commitment by USDA to look at trying to get flocks killed within 24 hours. This would have a huge impact on the control because it's going to eliminate the amount of virus in the environment. When I talk to people about biosecurity, I often tell them that biosecurity is like pasteurization, because people understand that pasteurization is reducing the number of bacteria, for example, in your milk, correct? This is a dairy state. So when we get pasteurized milk, it doesn't mean the milk is sterile, but it means that the bacteria in that milk have been reduced to a very small number. If there was a small number to start with, the milk actually might be sterile. If it's a high number to start with, if the milk has a high bacterial count before you pasteurize it, there will be a lot of survivors after pasteurization, and the milk will spoil quickly. So biosecurity is the same thing. If there's a lot of virus in the environment, then no matter how good your biosecurity is, it may not be enough. And this is how I explain, you know, part of the disaster that we experienced in the state. So some of the things that came about in response, Dr. Cardona then coordinated and is now leading an APHIS project that has been going on. She led the renewal request. That project has been going on for 10 years at the university, and now she is going to be the principal investigator. And that has to do with continuity of business and risk analysis for having to do with the spread of avian influenza. She also submitted a second proposal to APHIS having to do with investigation of outbreaks and doing outreach to industry veterinarians and to the poultry industry about trying to find out how these outbreaks occurred and then taking that information and supplying it back to the industry. They have several goals. And I won't go into what those goals are. If you want them, you're welcome to them. One of the questions, how is the money being spent? Because there was significant amount of state money that was directed to the university in the Rapid Agricultural Response Fund increase, and she helped coordinate the Rapid Ag Response request or the proposal that went in, and she did that by coordinating a number of faculty members that wanted to participate. So she vetted their proposals and winnowed them down until they fell within the budget, because of course university faculty members, you know, can never have enough money. So you know, there's
we do have that on record now.
Right. there's always research questions we would like to answer. As everybody has said, okay, I think the response in the state was absolutely phenomenal. Okay, if you go from March 5th to June 5th, that's April, May, June. That's about 3 months. It's really miraculous that this disease was actually controlled. You know, hopefully controlled in 3 months. That's exceptionally well done. I think the response by government agencies was also great, and we appreciate the money that's been directed at the University of Minnesota. I just want to make one small, slight, teeny comment about just because we have this rapid response money and that money does, research money does flow into the university, we don't exactly have a rapid management response effort, okay, within the university. Hear me, JD? This is a problem because it seemed like everybody in the state knew this was an emergency, except the people, you know, that are trying, that you have to go through to channel these funds, okay, so that jobs are still waiting to be posted, you know, we still wait for permission to post jobs, to hire people, to fill positions that could have been available the 1st of July. So just one small area where we could do a lot better. The second area where the university is involved is in collaboration with the Minnesota DNR, and Lou, I think, is going to tell you more about the DNR activities. But Drs. Pat Redding and Carol Cardona co-hosted a university meeting with the DNR to look at surveillance, and they invited experts from all across the country and from British Columbia. And Lou will tell you what the DNR is planning to do and what they are doing. I think what came out of this meeting is that there are some gaps. There are some things that may be missing. One of the things that's missing is our understanding of where the virus is in the winter and spring. This is not the first time that we've had influenza hit Minnesota in the early spring or late winter. February 27th is the earliest, but it's certainly not the first time. And so we do have a puzzle about where the virus is coming from when it hits us in the spring. We also don't understand what additional species of birds may harbor this virus. And so our understanding of then how this viral gene is, how the genes are moving, okay, is not clear as well. We know that influenza genes are shared between different influenza viruses, and we do not have a clear understanding of that. That's another gap. We have a gap in understanding bird behavior, okay, in response to weather events, for example. So we know how cold it was in February, but we may have forgotten how warm it was in January last year, and did that influence where the birds were. In the southwestern part of the state, there was not very much snow cover, and I don't know if that was true in February or not, but it was true in much of the winter. And then we also have a gap in not knowing exactly what the best sample is to collect from the bird. Historically, we have always sampled waterfowl by taking virus samples from the cloaca, the south end of a northbound bird, okay, and that's where the virus is most commonly found. With this highly pathogenic virus in waterfowl, it seems that that is not where most of the virus is. From some work done at ARS down at Athens, there's more virus in muscle and internal organs and from the oral pharyngeal swab than there is from the cloaca. So we have to figure out how to apply that, how to apply this to our regular surveillance. And then I think we need to focus the surveillance on the areas where the turkeys are. If you look at where the outbreaks happen, these outbreaks largely happened where the turkeys are. When it happens on the East Coast, it's going to happen where the turkeys are. When it comes back and hits the Midwest again, same thing will happen. So I think the most important wild bird surveillance is going to be, needs to be directed at where the disease would do the most damage. There's also a lot of coordination between the university and the Board of Animal Health. And this has already been mentioned by Dr. Hartman about the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory that's being planned, and I don't have anything to say about that. The University of Minnesota and the Board of Animal Health are working on a strategic development of a pre-movement poultry testing strategy. In other words, a strategy to test every poultry flock before those birds are moved to slaughter. And this, the plan is to do this starting this month, and certainly do it through December, and then make a decision on what to do after that. The final thing I'll mention about the efforts at the University of Minnesota is an epidemiology case control study. This is a study done with a private turkey company, and draft results that can be shared publicly are not yet available, but I am told that this will be happening. I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Halverson. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you so much for everything that you do and for your testimony as well. Mr. Cruz, will we be bringing up anybody else? Commissioners? Any other members from... Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, Santa Cruz back at the table. I believe that all we have left is some comments from Deputy Commissioner Jim Borboom on the RFA and some of the response there. And then I believe we do have people here from the DNR if there are questions, but we also want to be respectful of people's time. I do appreciate Mr. Chair and Chair Anderson calling this hearing and allowing us to talk about what we're doing, what we've learned, and what we're going to be doing going forward. And just keeping the conversation going around this issue, I think, is critical. So thank you.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, please state your name, who you represent for the record, if you would, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Borboom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Happy to be here today. Thank you for the hearing. I think it was a very constructive process. With respect to the RFA loan program, as you remember, one of the legislative changes you made was to increase the level of participation on the disaster recovery loan program from $50,000 to $200,000, where currently the Rural Finance Authority is currently offering the interest rate on those loans at 0%. And as Santo mentioned earlier, we've closed six loans in the amount of $647,000. That's less than what we anticipated, but in talking with some of the lenders that utilize this loan program, I think there's still some hesitation on part of the growers about what building improvement do I need to make in order to make that biosecurity measure. So we may see, I think there's a little bit of a delay before growers really decide what investments they're going to make as far as building improvements. If we have an outbreak this fall, I expect a lot higher increase or loan activity under this program.
Mr. Chair, members, again, if you have any questions, I know that about 99% of you know how to get a hold of me very quickly, so I will be available for that. And with that, Mr. Chair, again, thank you.
So I know we had the DNR as well. I think I may have failed to mention that. Are there any specific questions or are there any specific information that the DNR feels like they would like to provide at this time? Otherwise, we know how to get a hold of you as well, right? We know how to get a hold of you. Okay. Any questions, comments from members? Questions, comments. I see Commissioner Fredrickson's in the office or in the room as well. So it's good to see you as always. It's always nice to see you, not necessarily hear you. I'm just teasing. He's wonderful. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. I'm just trying to shed a little bit of humor on a very serious, serious situation. So, again, thank you so much for everybody involved. Ms. Hardy's not in the room, is she? From the governor's office?
No, Chantier's not here.
Yeah, she's not here. So I'd just like to give a little shout-out to her as well. I know she was working pretty hard on this, too. So thank you, everybody, that's been involved in all of this. And... Commissioner, Commissioner Franz is here as well. So thank you. He was recognized a little bit earlier. Commissioner Fredrickson must have been sleeping at that time. Once again, I'm teasing. Again, we take this very, very seriously. I want everybody to know that. With that, we like to have a little bit of fun as well. So thank you to everybody that's been involved. And with that, we are adjourned.